Muriel Rukeyser once rhetorically asked, "What would happen if one woman told the truth about her life?" "The world would split open," she said. In this special segment, I'm going to share one of those truths with you. We all have our origin story about the life experiences that shaped us in some way, sending us on a detour or leading us to a path far different than the one we might have imagined. One of those experiences for me happened when I became a secondary survivor after attending a college party with my friend who was separated from me for hours until I found her locked in a bedroom, naked and in a limp state, where she'd been vomiting while lying on her back. I remember suggesting that we should call 911 for help and being talked out of that by people at the party who said not to worry because this kind of thing happened all the time. It took four men and me to get my friend's clothes back on her body and carry her down a flight of stairs. I stayed next to her that night, propping her onto her side so she wouldn't vomit and choke. And I left in the morning when the sun finally started coming out. Turned out my friend had no memory of anything that had happened to her. I went with her to the women's center, and we became subjects in a college rape investigation. I remember getting calls from the roommate of my friend and from acquaintances advising me to keep my mouth shut unless I wanted to be responsible for ruining my friend's assailant's reputation. And so began my life path as an advocate, a journalist seeking to amplify voices that had otherwise been silenced, and a storyteller. This particular story that I'm going to tell you today is the story of another woman who I'll call June because she's asked that I not use her actual name. It's an unfortunate coming-of-age story from the rural town of Whitehall, Wisconsin. It happened more than two decades ago, and the woman, who is now a single mother of four, is still piecing her life back together.
There was a night in July of 1996, it was July 26, 1996 to be exact. My mother and her then-boyfriend got into an argument, and something was thrown through the screen door, a stroller or something, and the neighbors called the police, and Dan Wineski showed up, who was the police officer on duty, and he told me I had to come make a statement, and I said I would just walk because I lived right next door to the police station. He said no, he would take me down there.
June got into Officer Wineski's vehicle, but she didn't end up at the police station.
Instead of going to the station, he went down to the other end of town by the A&W, and I said this is not the police station, and he told me he was just making a quick trip through town to check on things. Instead of turning around, he went down, there's a little gravel road that'll take you past trees, and I think back there used to be the dog pound or something. He stopped on that little gravel road.
June says she knew she was in trouble.
I mean, when he stopped and parked, you know, I knew there was something that was wrong. I mean, just that sense with every fiber of my being that something was wrong. Plus, growing up in that town, there'd been rumors as far back as I can remember about him and things that he had done to other girls and women. So that was playing in my head. And I said, no, I'm going to get out now. And he said, no, you're not. And I was in the passenger seat, and I kept looking down because it was his gun. You know, I could see it. And I didn't know what to do or how to even react. Do I try to open the door? Do I run? I mean, where do I run? He's the police. Who do I tell? What do I do? And I asked what was going on, and I was under the impression I was having to give a statement. And he just said I wasn't stupid and not to play stupid. And I knew what was going to happen, and I needed to do what was expected.
What happened next would haunt June for the rest of her life.
I could hear my heart in my ears. I was cold and shaking, but yet sweating. And then I could hear his zipper on his pants. And then he stopped, and I heard like this button and stuff like that. And I looked, and he set his gun down on the dash, and it was pointed right at me. Then he grabbed the back of my head and was pushing me down into his lap. And I just said, no, 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 I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. Just stop. I won't tell anybody. Just let me go. I don't want to do this. I don't know what I'm doing. I was saying anything that could come out of my mouth.
Because you're 14 and he's trying to force you to perform oral sex.
Oral sex, yes. And I'm going to throw up, you know, anything I could think of. And he said very clearly and very matter of fact, as if he was just giving me driving instructions almost, but just do what you're told and be the good little whore that you know you are. And I had to start performing oral sex on him because I didn't know if he was going to shoot me or I didn't know what was going to happen. You know, I'll never forget any of that. The smell, I to this day cannot smell Tide laundry detergent because that's what I could smell was that smell. I didn't know it was Tide laundry detergent till after this had all happened and I smelt it again and it was a very strong reaction. You know, the feeling of it in my mouth, it was awful. And I just wanted it to be over. And he kept pushing my head down further and further. And I couldn't breathe. And then the radio went off and someone was talking on the radio. It was a call of some kind. And he just pulled me up really fast and told me to get out and, you know, not to fucking tell anybody or he would kill me. I opened the door as fast as I possibly could and fell. I just fell out. And I know my leg was burning, but I just got up and I ran. And I didn't even realize how far I had ran, but I don't know where I was going, but I didn't end up at home. I ran all the way to the other side of town past the laundromat and I collapsed. It was like a puddle. I don't know how long I laid there. I just was watching the clouds and everything seemed very surreal, almost like it was a dream. I can remember thinking, thank God that call came in. And at the very same time I thought that, I felt guilty because I was thankful that someone needed help, you know, that someone else was in danger or in peril. And because of their situation, it saved me.
June eventually made her way back home, but even home didn't feel like a safe place to land.
I could see the broken screen door and it was all like instantaneous again, because it was like, that was the reason. You know, I was angry, but yet scared and everything, just so many different emotions at one time. And I couldn't go tell my mom what happened. I didn't want to bring, I don't know. I don't know if shame isn't the right word, but I believed a lot of that, you know, dirty whore. And, you know, I was from the wrong side of the tracks. And so that was ringing in the back of my head.
Soon he came back to her home again to respond to another domestic disturbance between her mom and stepdad.
There was another fight at my house. And the cops got called because my mom and stepdad were drunk and fighting and the neighbors got called. And this time I think it was a small TV. Everything always went through our screen door. It was just kind of like we stopped fixing it because it just kept getting broken. And Wineski showed up and he said, well, you're going to have to come make a statement. And I said, oh, no, I'm not falling for that again. I said, if you're telling me I have to, I will walk over there and I will go into the police station and do it. I'm not going with you, because I didn't know if I had the right to say no. Like, he was making it sound like I would be arrested or I would be in some kind of serious trouble. And so I did. And I went over there and asked me a couple of questions about it. And he again had his weapon, but he put it on the table and he said that he would put that inside of me and pull the trigger if I ever pulled that shit again.
And then seemingly showed up wherever she was.
I skipped school with a bunch of friends and he caught us going to my house. And you know, they're supposed to take you back to school. He didn't. He sat there and winked at us and said, okay, girls, go in there and have your nice little quiet party. And I won't tell anybody that I saw you. And, you know, I would just glare at him because I knew why he was being that way. And there was another time that I was literally outside my house and he was parked in the big parking lot right there in the squad car. And he told me to go over there. He called my name. I could hear him. And I walked over there and he said, you're supposed to be in your house. It's past curfew. And I said, I'm in my front yard. You know, I'm not breaking curfew. And he smacked me across the face.
Without a template for healthy relationships, June found herself in a cycle of abusive relationships. And when something happened between June and her then-boyfriend, Officer Wineski was there to respond.
JJ had been driving me around in his car, and he was really mad at me. And Dan Wineski pulled us over, and he could see that I was upset. I'm sure he could see that, you know, my face was messed up. And he goes, well, you have two choices. Do you want to stay with him, or do you want to come with me? I basically had to choose between one hell or the other, you know? And at least with JJ, I thought I had a fighting chance.
June has her suspicions about why the officer chose her.
He had had interactions with me in the past from running away from home or my mom calling because we were arguing and I was refusing to listen. You know, I was very angry as a youth.
June's mother was 18 when she had her, and she had fled an abusive marriage to move to this tiny town in the middle of Wisconsin for a fresh start.
My mom was a single mom for pretty much my whole life. My dad and her got divorced when I was 2. She did the best she could with what she had. And she was a bartender, you know, that's what she always did, but she was an alcoholic. And then her boyfriend, who she had the fight with that night, is now my stepfather. You don't know how to deal with being a teenager anyways when you're a teenager, and then you add all the messed up home stuff, and it made me very angry to where I would kind of just do what I wanted to do. My mom would ground me, but I would still leave. You know, so he had interactions with me.
Your mom had called him to help with family issues?
He was always the hero. My mom thought that he was one of the good guys because he didn't make her feel like she was worthless or put her down like a lot of people in that town had. And my mom by no means was a villain in this story. She just was a kid, you know, raising a kid. And she didn't have a support system. And he knew that.
June says she had to grow up fast.
Sometimes I felt like I was the mom.
June was almost 14 when her mom gave birth to June's younger sister.
And then she had my little sister, who I love dearly, but I took on the responsibility of taking care of her pretty much full time.
And in the meantime, you're a teenager who's struggling and not feeling great yourself.
Yes. Yep. But, you know, she became my world. And I would go to school and pick her up from the babysitters, and a lot of times I would be taken care of for all night because my parents didn't come home, or, you know, my stepdad, he worked in Alaska, so he was driving and gone a lot. It was tough, but her and I have a very strong relationship because of that.
June says her family is an example of how intergenerational cycles of struggle and violence can be.
My grandmother is also an alcoholic. So was her real father. And then her stepfather, an alcoholic. So there was always alcohol. And I think there was a lot of kids parenting themselves. I love my grandmother to death, but, you know, they weren't hands-on or necessarily the best at raising kids. You know, and obviously you repeat what you know, until you can break the cycle or figure out how to do that. And I did that. And I didn't know I was doing that.
By 16, June was pregnant with her own first child. It was then that she mustered up the courage to speak to the chief of police about what Officer Wineski had done to her.
I seen him at his vehicle, not his cop car, but just his personal vehicle. And I walked over to him and I said, I really need to talk to you about something. And that was all I said. And I swear, without missing a beat, he goes, does it have to do with Wineski? And so I was like, yeah. And he goes, okay. He's like, well, I'm not on duty right now, so I officially can't take your statement. But when I come on duty, I'm going to come talk to you and we'll get this worked out.
But that's not what happened.
A couple hours later, I was home and we had like a front screened-in porch area and someone was knocking on the door and I opened it and it was Wineski. And he was not happy. Wineski informed me that nobody would be by to take my statement because there was nothing to take a statement on. And I needed to stop making up little high school girl stories. And he took his gun out and made me hold it under my chin. I stood there just terrified. You know, I didn't like guns. And I can remember it was like the heaviest thing it felt like it weighed 1,000 pounds. And I was so terrified because I was shaking and I thought, if I even breathe wrong, this is gonna go off. You know, I had no idea. And he just told me to remember how that felt. And you wouldn't want to find your sister decapitated on your front steps.
So you're in this vulnerable place and then you're assaulted by a police officer and your words don't matter if that's what message you're given. So how does that kind of set you up for the future in the way that you use your voice or don't use your voice?
I always, if it would get sexual, I felt like I would have to say yes. So I kind of just didn't even look to date or anything because I didn't know how to say no. I didn't know how to just back away from that situation. The other way is I felt like being vulnerable would be used against me and that would open me up to be hurt again. So I always have this huge, tough exterior and I'm always working on everybody else because then I don't have to acknowledge, you know, what's going on within me. I have felt pretty much my whole life that what's going on inside of me doesn't matter because I didn't have the stability. I didn't have the safe zone. You know, I didn't know where that was.
Still a kid herself, June embarked on her own journey of motherhood at 16, never again speaking about what the Whitehall officer had done to her.
Until years later, when a federal investigator showed up at her door in La Crosse, Wisconsin. It turned out that many other women had begun speaking about their interactions with the officer. But the name that kept coming up over and over was June's.
When everything started to unfold and I was reading all these interviews, my name was everywhere. So it was obvious that my neighbors and the community knew that he had a fixation on me and that I had been a victim in some way, shape, or form, whether it was stalking or harassment. My name just kept coming up. And I had no idea because I felt all alone. Because I guess in my mind, and even then, I thought somebody would help. If somebody would step up and do what's right, but nobody did.
It turned out that while June suffered alone, it wasn't because people didn't know.
There was so many people in Whitehall that had the ability and the power to change it, to stop it, to prevent some of it, and nobody did anything. And from what I can see, it hasn't really changed.
Well, other women who'd been victimized by the Whitehall police officer had come forward. June's case was the one that fell inside the statute of limitations. June reluctantly agreed to participate in the investigation.
Officer Wineski ultimately was charged.
He was facing 33 years, and then he took what they call is an Alford plea. It's a way of pleading guilty without admitting your guilt.
June returned to Whitehall for the officer's sentencing hearing.
I went, my counselor came, my midwife came, my mom was there. The courtroom was packed. A couple of the other victims were there. They didn't get to speak, and I knew who they were, but, you know, they were there. I walked in, and Larry Estenson actually smiled and got up and tried to, like, talk to me, and how are you doing? And it was almost like an out-of-body experience.
Cynthia Ganote is a gender sociologist. I asked her to speculate about why so many people in the town were willing to be passive bystanders rather than facing the truth.
I think it makes people feel they can control the circumstances. Oh, well, that was her. She was fill in the blank instead of, let's be frank, it could happen to anyone.
And Ganote says, for some, it can be easier or more comfortable to accept the simple narrative that he, the officer, is a nice guy, and she, the victim, has a reputation.
So many people individualize situations. I think that's our mainstream go-to. Someone experiences poverty and people go to, what did that person do wrong? Where are they to blame? Where are they at fault? As a sociologist, I really like to take the lens away from the individual for a moment and say, what are the cycles in which that person has been immersed? What was that child born into? Was it a cycle of intergenerational poverty? Was that person born into a situation where gender-based abuse has happened? When you use that structural lens, you begin to ask, how did this happen? How did an officer of the law, who seen as a quote unquote nice guy by everyone, how was that a serial predator who in fact had access to underage girls on a regular basis? And how did this town, how did this operate? And how did any complicity with fellow officers or anyone else, how did this system work that allowed this man to be a serial predator and to deeply damage the lives of young girl after young girl.
This, Gnaeut says, leads to internalized oppression, which leads to silence and continues the cycle of violence.
Patriarchy itself is the backdrop here. Then you have a young woman who, from this age of 14, is coerced into a sexual act by an authority figure who has been presented to her as a quote unquote nice guy by people in the town and by her own mother, who, all of whom saw him as such because he presented as such. In fact, having this kind of predator come at an early age and violate her sexually and her boundaries and her sense of what an authority figure does, it makes a lot of sense that a number of women in that situation then have further traumatic relationships with men in their path.
Sometimes, Gnaeut says, blaming the victim can feel safer than facing the reality that it could happen to any one of us, even you.
You end up in the truly frightening realization that is absolutely accurate. It could happen to you. It could happen to your child. It could happen to your niece or nephew. It could happen to anyone when the system supports predators like this continuing rather than having systems of accountability, not just for officers, yes, for officers, for everyone.
Well, June was relieved that the officer was sentenced to several years in prison. There was too much turmoil in her own life and in her situation with her ex-husband for her to feel safe.
My ex-husband knows how to talk, knows what to say, how to make you feel like you're the most amazing, special, only person on the face of the earth, and then turn it around some way without you even realizing it. I didn't see it happening, getting so far into my head that I had no idea who I was anymore. I mean, the lure to that was he made me feel special. He made me feel like he was listening to me, like I mattered. He didn't know about the Wineski stuff or anything like that, but I would tell him things about my past relationship or my mom and things like that. And he'd be like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Things are going to be so different. I'm going to take care of you. And warning signs, what it should have been, was A, he was already married and trying to woo me. You know, hello, red flag. He told me, I have not had sex with my ex-wife in many months, we're separated. Well, then her and I ended up having a baby 3 months apart. So clearly that was false, you know, but he always had a way to make me feel sorry for him. Like he was the victim. And I can tell you right now, one of the most vivid memories I have is one of the times I caught him cheating. I actually, after we were done having the conversation, was sitting in our living room sobbing and apologizing to him for him cheating on me. He was like, it's okay. I know you didn't mean it.
By 2012, it was clear to June that her now ex-husband was not the protector he'd once made himself out to be.
When Wineski got off of supervision completely in 2012, my ex-husband would tell me almost daily, I'm going to tell him where he lives. I'm going to tell him where you live. I'm going to watch when he shows up. And I'll be like, we have kids. You know, what are you talking about? And he didn't care. And so I made the decision to take my kids and I was going to run to Canada because Wineski couldn't get me in Canada. My husband probably wouldn't care enough to try to find me there. He would just move on to another girl. And I was going to flee. I didn't know how he was going to do that. I wasn't allowed to work. I wasn't allowed to have money. My ex-husband controlled all of that. You know, I didn't have any identity outside of him, but I knew I wasn't going to let my kids be harmed.
Feeling like she had no other option, she wrote bad checks to get cash, hoping she could get a fresh start, but her plan backfired.
I opened a checking account and I wrote a bunch of bad checks off my own account. And I would buy things and sell them. And I was hoarding the cash because I needed money, right? And I was keeping a list of where I'd written these checks because I was going to find a way to make it right. I was going to pay these checks back. But right now, I needed to get my kids out of there. I had to get out of there. I didn't think about the how I was going to make this or the logical part of my brain, which is there, was not kicking in saying, whoa, caution, this is dumb, this isn't going to work. Well, it didn't work. I got arrested. They took all the money and they kept it. And I still don't know exactly where that goes. And it never got applied to the restitution because I had to pay all that back. But it did get me away from my ex-husband.
Now, June's name carries the felon asterisk behind it, making it hard for her to secure employment or follow her dream of being an advocate for other women experiencing trauma.
It haunts me. I mean, I had to quit school because I was in nursing school, and they said they couldn't put me anywhere to do my clinicals because of my criminal record. I haven't been able to find good jobs. I had somebody at an employment agency look me straight in my eye and tell me if I was a sex offender, I'd have a better chance of getting employed than money crimes. Because nobody cares about the reasoning, you know? And I haven't been in trouble since, you know, but it follows me around, and that's all directly related. And that's when I decided I can't keep being a victim. You know, and that's why I knew I wanted to write. I knew I wanted to tell my story. I want people to know that this stuff happens, and it happens a lot more than what I even know.
June says her own situation makes it impossible for her not to be critical of the officers in George Floyd's case.
It angers me. I've seen so many people post about George Floyd and his criminal past and his past doings. Was he an angel? Absolutely not. But he did not deserve to be murdered. I don't care what he did. You know, they murdered him in front of the entire world and nobody did anything. And I've also seen a lot of people say, well, those bystanders didn't do anything. I can understand that and I appreciate that, but I can also understand why they wouldn't. There's that fear of the police, and then you want to believe like this isn't going to end that way. You know, I think it's just a safety mechanism for our minds to try to come to the best conclusion so that way we don't realize how terrifying things can be.
How do you feel about the other police being held accountable? And
that's different. They're not just bystanders. You know, their job and their oath is to help serve and protect. And they didn't do any of that. Now, a couple of them were new or fairly new or whatever. I don't care. You know, they still knew right from wrong. There was no reason they couldn't have tapped him out, so to speak, and be like, I've got it from here, go cool down or whatever. You know, if all three of those officers would have done the right thing, we would have had a different outcome. And there is not enough education for people. People are going on stereotypes, and it's not okay. And the police think they can do it. You know, you think the Band of Brothers is strong in a huge police force, in a police force of like 5 people, it's Teflon, nothing sticks. I mean, the things that I read in the, when this was all going on and the stuff that he did for 25 years, Dan Wineski, everybody knew.
June says she had to learn to care for herself before she could care for others.
I was taking care of my mom. I was taking care of my sister, you know, and then I was having babies. You know, by the time I was barely 22, I had 3 kids. And I've just always been taking care of everybody else, which I used, I guess, as a distraction. But it's been very detrimental because failing to take care of myself, I've actually failed others, you know, my children, you know, trying to protect them. But I was protecting them in the wrong way, you know, or trying to get them to forget about stuff. I would just go out and buy them things that they didn't need because, you know, I just didn't want them to think about the bad stuff. I did not set good examples for relationships with them. And I tried to protect my kids. I was determined, right? Remember I said that I was going to give them. I had the same cycle of crap, that only in a different way. I didn't drink, you know, I don't do drugs, but they witnessed abuse. They were abused mostly emotionally and mentally, but some physically by my ex-husband. And I see the stuff that their dad pulls and how he manipulates them. And it kills me to no end. And I will bear that cross forever, probably. I don't know if I'll ever fully forgive myself because I did not break that cycle. I can guarantee you if we were to talk to 100 women who have been abused or assaulted or whatever, and they've lived this, especially for a long period of time, they have no sense of identity. They have no sense of self. I didn't even know what kind of eggs I liked after I left my husband because I had always done everything his way. I am a chameleon. I mean, even in friendships, I would become the person that I thought they wanted me to be. I was never really me.
Since the interview, June and the father of her youngest child split, and she landed a job back in the same small place where she was once a victim. With lots of hard work and the support of a therapist, June says she has transitioned from a victim to a survivor. While June still faces some of the residual emotional trauma she has endured and knows the familiar struggle that many single moms face of making ends meet, she has high hopes for the future.
If I can help other people find their voice and I can help other people feel strong, then I will continue to get my strength and I will continue to have my voice. And that can't be taken from me anymore. And that can't be silenced anymore.